so you like free stuff? Like,
yeah.
And we're live. That's the way we do it. We just kind of go right into it. I get some background chatter, and it sounds completely unprofessional, but that's what we do here at the Wait What If podcast, number 17. I feel like I should have a speech set up for number 17. Do you know what it actually sounds like on my end?
What's that?
It sounds like we're in a bar or something.
I hear it's fitting.
I hear that's right. Yeah. So who we have on right now is Chris Millington, who is a heck of a lot older than me. I think born 7 days prior or 10
about
days.
7 days. Yeah.
Yeah.
10 days. Yeah.
December 7th. 76. Yeah. Don't you hate that being a 76er because we never. I don't like to talk about that part.
The F word.
But we identify. We identify more with the 77 kids because we're the tail end of the 1976 kids.
Yeah, I don't know. I've always associated myself as one of the, I've always been thought of as one of the older kids in, you know, growing up. So 76 was, you know, I took pride in 76.
Did you? I never, I guess, really thought about it. So Chris is a, and what is your exact title? I always just tell people you're a toy maker. You live in the North Pole. You have a beard.
that's what my children will tell you.
You're a jolly old.
My belly does shake when I giggle, but for other reasons. No, I'm actually recently transposed into the president role at Maxim Enterprise.
Really?
Yep.
Wow, that's cool. The president.
Back in April.
So, so the president then of Maxim Enterprise. That's the magazine, of course, right?
I wish. Although we do actually get phone calls for them, which is kind of funny.
Yeah. Do you really?
Yeah.
So if you can't tell by the recording, Chris is up in Brockton? No, where are you? You're
East Taunton, Massachusetts.
East Taunton, where it's probably already snowing there, right?
It was actually 85 today.
Get out. It was actually cooler down here.
Yeah, it was very warm.
El Nino. El Nino, I am. No, what's he say?
Yo soy El Nino, otherwise known as the Nino.
The Nino. Chris and I grew up. Actually, we have a lot of similarities. I mean, being of the same generation, we grew up with. back when I thought that. What's that a**'s name again? Adam Sandler. Back when I used to think he was funny. Yeah. I don't know what that was. And then, obviously.
Chris, it's definitely one of those humors that doesn't you know hold up to the times,
doesn't translate at all. There was like four
Farley
movies.
Maybe yes,
oh sure, yeah. Because he died, he did the right thing. In order to be a classic in today's day and age, you gotta drop dead at whatever he was, 25, 30. Who do you think's the next
but
to
the
go?
Best part is that who's the next to go?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, Jesus. Who's gonna be the classic that goes down accidentally? Do we have any crazy comedians now? The kids, what do they listen to? What do the kids do today?
Kevin Hart? I don't know.
Yeah, he's like little and healthy. They're like those little dogs. They last forever.
Did you really? I mean, who's the girl that kind of took like Chris Farley's place?
That's
is it, like,
right.
Kristen McCarthy?
Yeah.
Or what, she's in the new Ghostbusters movie.
She is a little.
She's got a chance.
She could be the one. And we'll all talk about her as the great. I hope she's not a fan of the show. Let me check my list. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. All five of them. Nope. That's she's not on it. So cool. President of Maxim. And did you back up to like the history of the company? Because I know your dad was high up in it too, right?
Yep. So he was actually the CEO and president before I kind of took the reins. He, just to give a little history, he kind of was the one that pulled me into the toy industry. Mm-hmm. He started out back in the day as a stock boy at JCPenney back in the late 60s, worked his way up to like a store manager, became a buyer. Then people actually used to think we were in the military when I was growing up because we moved so much. He changed jobs a lot in different buying positions, and throughout the years just gained a wealth of knowledge of the industry, gained a multitude of contacts. And his last job prior to starting with Maxim was working for a very, very small company you might have heard of called Hasbro.
Really?
Yeah, he worked for them for about 10 years. And 1 year, him and about 300 other people who were over the age of 50 got let go.
They just canned them.
they just canned all these people. This was probably 91. So, and he was coming off like he was, and I don't like to admit this to a lot of people, but he was one of the key factors in being responsible for the success of Barney, the purple dinosaur.
Really?
That's basically what put me through college. So, coming off the success of that, Hasbro said, hey, you know,
how did
we don't need these people.
Back up. And, wait, wasn't Barney a giant dinosaur? He's a purple dinosaur. You think I would know this with two little kids, but I don't allow it in the house. I'm like, nope.
Yeah, Barney. Barney's kind of gone the way of the dodo. So it was basically I can't remember exactly, but I believe it was a woman who came up with the story. She had originally had like a children's book and a small little puppet, like a purple dinosaur. Mm-hmm. And it actually started out as a purple bear.
Okay.
But in whatever think tank they came up with, they're like, oh, you know, bears have been done. You know, Teddy Ruxpin had been done. Like, let's do something with dinosaurs, because all the little kids love dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. So they made this big, giant purple dinosaur. Had, you know, a couple different people voice the characters.
They started with Mr. T, right? And they worked their way down?
Yes. No, but kind of a funny little trivia fact. I don't know if you remember Jackie Joyner-Kersee.
Yeah, Olympic.
The Olympic runner.
Yeah.
Her brother was the guy that was inside the suit.
Really?
So he was like pretty much almost like an Olympic athlete, and so he could jump around and do all the like funny animated, you know, poses and moves. And you know, they had him working on the show. And my father was responsible for all of the marketing, import, product development, all that kind of stuff to bring all the retail product to the consumers.
Yeah.
So he was in charge of a small division at Hasbro called Kid Dimensions.
I was going to say, your dad is like the perfect for marketing and sales. I mean, just larger than life persona.
He's
big toothy grin.
He is big Tom Callahan.
Yeah.
From Tommy Boy. You know, and I like to think of myself as Chris Farley sometimes.
Who was the guy from Saturday Night Live a long time ago? Braswell.
Bill Bradsky, that's who it was.
You remember that one? They're all sitting at a bar.
Yeah, Bill Bradsky.
Yeah, they're sitting in the bar, and like it was usually Alec Baldwin was one of the guys that was in that skit.
Your dad's Bill Bradsky.
Yeah, he could sell. So he started out with that. So he already had the connections at the retailers. He had the connections on the manufacturing end. So it just made sense to kind of pretty much become his own boss.
Yeah.
And he started out just working out of his house, you know, and doing a few, you know, connections here and there, and then got to the point where he was just growing so rapidly that he couldn't do it on his own anymore. Mm-hmm. So he hired a couple people to do some administrative work, got an accounting manager. And at the time, I was only two years out of college.
Yeah.
And was working for a marketing group, this trade show company called Traffic Builders.
That's right. I remember them. Are they still around?
And they are still in existence.
Because they flew me out to Vegas once. Remember? You guys needed...
Yes, you worked with me. Yeah,
that's right. They needed someone, and I was out of work.
Yeah.
Because after college, I mean... What was it, 99? It was right after the internet bubble burst, and unless you had a very specific job, which I was a history major, you were what, communications?
So
you're screwed.
A little bit, you know, step up.
I got out of college and literally I didn't know what I was going to do. I spent all my graduation
money.
Did
you work for John Hancock?
I did. Well, do you remember that guy with the I can't even remember. I don't remember anyone's name. That's the other funny thing. I don't remember anyone's, like, I try to think back in college and I'm like, it's just weird. I think it's just because it's almost 20 years ago. It was 20 years ago that I started college.
It was 20 years ago that
we started
college.
Yeah. That's crazy.
We're actually having a little reunion.
Oh, really?
For our homecoming, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow. So let's pause on that for one quick second. I want to go back to when I actually met you, because now you got me thinking here. It was.
It's all coming back.
It is. It was back in 1996. I want to say it was 95 or 96. I want to say it was more like 96.
So it was 96 because you were pledging.
That's right. Your fraternity.
Spring the semester 96.
Yeah. The one that you had already pledged semester before. So you guys were the old guys.
I was an actual brother.
Yeah, that's right, man. I look back on that stuff and I don't know. I had fun, I guess. I guess. I don't know. It's some people can't let it go, and I'll probably get in trouble for anyone from the fraternity that listens to this stuff. But I remember about, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago, someone had mentioned something on Facebook, and I was like, hey, I don't even remember my pledge number. And everyone's like, blowbag, you loser. And then I wrote on there, I was like, I don't know, I got married, had kids, joined the military, went to war, went to grad school. Like, I had a few things.
A life.
Yeah, and then I got completely hated on for like four pages, and I was like, I guess I'll just stop posting on here.
Yeah. I went back to homecoming 1 year, and for the life of me, I couldn't remember the position, the name of the position I held, even though I was president of the fraternity. I couldn't remember the actual, like,
the term
name,
president?
Eminent commander was the actual term. And I'm like, I can't. They're like, yeah, you were the EM, right? I'm like, the what?
Yeah.
Like, sure. I probably did that at a party once. What?
It's just, college is just... And I don't even know what it is nowadays, because when we were there, it was just starting to become this big PC thing. I mean, they still allowed comedians on campus. There wasn't a lot of, I mean, the PC police were around, but it wasn't that bad. Remember that movie PCU came out? Yeah. I tried watching that the other night. It's unwatchable.
Yeah.
It was watchable in 96, but you can't watch it. That's just dumb.
Yeah.
But I was watching PCU, and I guess it's just a coincidence. I was watching that, and now we're talking about college back in the 90s. But it was all about how that stuff's coming up. And then nowadays, I don't even know what kids do in college. I honestly have no idea. I don't think they can
draw. Well, I don't know if you saw it. I mean, it made national news. I don't know if you saw it down there, but UNH was actually, you know, one of the institutions that was in the news because they put out an actual in their print, whatever they send out to the students, whether it's like a handbook or whatever nowadays, that there's certain words that they're not supposed to use in their vernacular. And one of them was like American.
You can't use the term American.
American. It was like one of those, it was like American and like something else, but it's like, you're not supposed to use American. And they got so much, like, obviously they got so much grief for it.
They should.
The president, like, I mean, it was literally like, Obama like made a comment on this, and I'm just like, oh yeah, that's the university that I went to. That's
weird. And what Chris is talking about for the listeners is University of New Hampshire in the beautiful Durham, North Carolina. Crap, that's where I live. Durham, New Hampshire. It's actually really I like the school. It's gorgeous, but
yeah, it was a great school.
What a freaking bunch of words.
They put out like words that were not appropriate.
You can't say freshman, right?
You can't say freshman. I mean, there was, I don't know the whole list. Like, I didn't actually want to waste any of my time on it because it was just ridiculous.
That's horrible.
But, yeah, there was at least like five or six different words that they were just ridiculous.
What are we doing to it? Doesn't help. It doesn't help anyone. The idea of banning words is the most bizarre thing, because the words are there. They're there, and that's all they are words. This whole idea of the N-word, right? So they ban that word. It's a word, first off, and if you want to use it, I guess you're the asshole that uses it, but it's just a word. And then we call it, so then we change it to the N-word. And now, doesn't just saying the N-word become the word?
Yeah.
I mean, aren't you just, because that's all a word is a symbol representing a definition.
It's an interpretation of, it's like, you know, son of a bee. It's you already still know I'm saying son of a bitch. Like, mm-hmm. It's just education is really what it comes down to. It's, you know, educating your kids that, okay, there's certain words you say when you're hanging out with your buddies. I have three boys, and, you know, my father raised me in a way. I maybe have heard my father say the F word twice in my life, and they were probably both in jokes that he was trying to say during, like, a cocktail hour or something.
Yeah, okay. I was going to think, the day he saw you born. Parents, like,
that too. But no, but like I look at it, and, you know, I try not to swear around my kids. Like, it's one of those things, like, to try and be respectful in front of my wife, and, you know, I try and have a good head on their shoulders. And it gets to a point where I know they're going to swear. I know, like, when they're like 12, 13 years old, they're going to want to be, you know, like, oh yeah, like, I just, keep it real. I just said this and I just said that.
Not like,
you know, they're going to get some street cred in East Taunton.
Not like when they're 18 or 19, he's like, you know, when they're 7 or 8 and after they're knocked off their first liquor store, they'll be swearing.
No, but it's one of the other funny things is just, you know, even just, you know, having friends our age that now have a bunch of little kids, you know, running around the same age. Like, I will never judge another person, or at least I'll never say that I'll judge another person to their face.
Yeah.
But you always compare, like, you know, you have two little kids, like, you always look at how you're trying to raise your kids. And then when you see other people with little kids, you're like Jen and I will be like, in a situation, we won't say anything, but you just give that nod of like, I know exactly what you're thinking right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's this, you know, it's almost like a classical conditioning that, like, they've elicit a response by saying this word, so they're the ones that have instilled it in him that, like, oh, if I say this word, I'm gonna get a positive reaction.
Yeah.
So they learn how to say it, they say it, and then all of a sudden it's like, ooh, we probably shouldn't have done that. But it's, I think it's our generation that don't always think about the consequences of their own actions.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. Yeah, I think too. And what's his name, Penn and Teller, Penn's the one that talks, right? Yeah, Penn Jillette.
Yeah, Teller's
the one that doesn't. He lets his kids swear, and he was saying it's because it's just a word. And to just allow it to be a word takes the power away from it.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I mean, we don't swear. I mean, I don't swear in front of my kids. I every now and then, it was funny. I had my son in the sink. I was washing his feet because they were all muddy. And he's sitting there. He's only two. And he slides into the sink, and it splashes everywhere. And he goes, oh, shit. It's so funny because you know he got it from one of us.
Well, yeah, but it's great too that you think you're like, you don't want to react because you don't want to see what they're going to do. Well, you don't want them to take it in a negative manner, but at the same time, like, sometimes you're actually proud that they used it in the right context.
yeah it's one of those things. What do you got? You got a little person walking around?
No, my Jen just came down. She was
For the love of God, Jen.
She brought me some ice, so I love her.
Oh, there you go. Ice your marbles. Yeah, I guess it is, again. I mean, you can't look at anything with regret, and that's something that I've taken away over the last few years. When I say few years, I mean, things are becoming more... What are you doing? It sounds like you're just peeing pouring into a cup.
I got a big cup, but, you know.
I think, there you go. The closer you get to 40, and you hear the term midlife crisis and everything, and I'm not really having a midlife crisis, but you start to realize, and I think I said this in my email to you when I was like, you got to come on the show, is that you might be coming to the fewer days left than you've already lived once you hit 40.
Oh, yeah.
And these things you think about, you start reflecting on your life and when did things change and what did you learn? And especially when you have people now that depend on you, people that you have to turn into viable human beings. You look over your decisions you made in your life and you're like, how am I not going to F this up for them? And we will. I mean, you know that. I mean, someday.
Oh, definitely. Kids,
yeah. And Ed Seinfeld said to, there's a show called Riding in Cars with Comedians or something on Crackle. Yep. Yeah, it's a good show. And
I've only seen a few small episodes.
He was on with Patton Oswalt, and Patton Oswalt was like, and I come downstairs and the TV's on and my daughter's sitting in front of the TV and there's like a murderous clown on, and I'm like, no, and I turn it off because I'm thinking, you know, at some point this is going to mess her up and she's going to be in a... And Seinfeld's like, no, it's never that. It's someday she's going to want vanilla and you get her mint chocolate chip. Something that mundane, and that's what's going to screw him up in the long run.
Minute.
Yeah. And that's...
Yeah, I
Well, I was just going to say, and I guess that's how you got to take it. I mean, you just have to do what you think is right. And it only takes, it takes common sense, I think, to raise kids and making sure that you don't screw them up for the most part.
Oh, definitely. And it's one of those things, as long as you have a good head on your shoulders, and I don't want to say you limit their intake of social media and everything in the news and everything like that, because you definitely you can't protect them from that. You just have to make sure that you're educating them enough that they understand what's going on and, you know, just not being complete idiots.
And it takes a lot of sacrifice too, and I think people miss that point. They think that, well, two things. I think if you have a kid, your life's over, and it's not. You just have to redefine things, number one. And number two, the, I guess that's one extreme. The other extreme is, I'm not going to change anything. And it's when you don't change anything that you end up, I think, being a lousy parent, because you're not putting these little people ahead of you. And they have to be. They have to come number one. Yeah. And I mean, I guess you can't understand that if you don't have kids, but I think actually in a way you can, because being selfless is a trait that maybe having kids teaches you, but it also, I guess if it doesn't teach you and you're naturally selfless, and I guess you can understand, but it comes with the territory, and I don't regret, I guess I shouldn't use that term, but I don't miss, you know, going out till midnight on Fridays, or look at me, midnight, no, you know, like 1 or 2 a.m. on Fridays. I don't miss that, because that was a life that I had. Now I actually enjoy watching my son try to figure out how to catch a ball. I mean, that's where the enjoyment comes, and you have to redefine things, and some people, I guess, miss that. They don't catch that, and they're like, no, I still have to have my life, and I still have my life, but it's just redefined.
It's definitely one of those things where, you know, I have designers that work for me that are, you know, in their 20s and 30s, and, you know, they're still in that stage where they're like, oh, I can't imagine having kids, or I don't know if I'm ever going to want to have kids.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, I always, and I don't know if it was just because of the way I was brought up, or, you know, just the fact that it was a natural progression that kind of is ingrained in us growing up, because of the, you know, the full American dream of having a nice house, having a family and a picket fence. Like, it's just one of those things. It's like, okay, you go to school, you get a job, you have a family, maybe you buy a dog. You know, not necessarily in that order, but it's like, it's one of those things that's ingrained. But I think people that don't have children, you can have a dog and you can train your dog and teach his tricks, and it's great. But the one thing that I realized, you know, when I had my first son, was that it's so amazing when you actually teach them something that they retain. And, you know, the first time they, you know, say a word that you taught them, or the first time, like you said, you're playing catch with your son and they throw their first spiral, or like they do something, you're like, oh my God, like I just instilled something into another human being.
Yeah.
And that was me. Like, I did that. Like, no one else in this world did that. I did that. Dude. And it's so profound that you're just like, wow. And then you're like, wait a minute. Like, this is kind of dangerous. Like, this power is so dangerous. Like,
with great power comes great responsibility.
Exactly.
I can make my own warriors. Oh my
God. Like, I can, you know, and I've got three, so I can almost have my own social experiment. Like, okay, I'm going to be a complete dick to this one, see how he turns out. I'm going to spoil this one, and this one I'm not even going to pay attention to.
Child Protective Services is listening right now. Again, this is Chris Millington.
I love all of my sons equally. And
yeah, you have all boys.
All boys. Even their dog's a boy.
Wow. That's your poor wife. So you had kids and all that stuff, and you become the president. You said that happened a couple years ago. Is that after your dad got sick?
So, nope. So my dad, he had wanted to, he had thought about retiring for the last few years. But again, being of the old school, you know,
Bill Bradsky,
like, you know, the old Bill Bradsky didn't want to give up the keys to the family farm.
Like, he truly was Bill, or is Bill Bradsky. He flies airplanes. He had the Z3 for a while.
Yeah, that was my mom's car. That was
okay. I remember you and I were driving it once.
he's definitely lived the life and experienced more than a lot of people ever will. And it's one of those things, and, you know, not to get off the subject, but it was one of those things growing up as a child with my father in the industry. I never wanted to get into what he did.
Right.
And mostly because he traveled all the time. I mean, he would be on the road at times for, you know, again, it was like he was in the military. He'd be gone for a month at a time, 2 months at a time. And back in the day when he would do a buying trip, he would travel to Japan, then he'd go to Korea, then he'd go to China, and just, you know, this is before the internet and email and, you know, being able to have a Skype conversation, you know, like we're having. And, you know, it was, you know, they were telefaxing stuff and, you know, doing like Morse code just to get information.
I don't even know what a telefax
is. He would have to go to these like remote places in, you know, inner China. That I started going to China about 16 years ago.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And even just in those 16 years, it's just an astonishing change of how much growth and just advancement in the local environment has been. Just so I can't even imagine what it was like back in the 70s and early 80s. But I told myself he was gone for a large majority of my childhood that, you know, I would never get back. And I always told myself, you know, when I grow up, I want to be there for my kids. I don't want to be traveling as much. I don't want to be on the road. You know, I don't want to be the dad that when my son, you know, if he decides to play football, if he decides to do ballet, I don't want to be the dad that has to watch the video that the mom took from the actual event. I want to be able to be at those events. Like, I want to be there for my son. And it wasn't until later in life that I actually realized, like you were talking about earlier, the sacrifices that you make for your children. And that my dad, like, he wished that he could be there. He, you know, it tore him apart internally that he wasn't there for my sister and I as much as he wanted to be when we were younger.
Sure.
But he knew that he needed to do that in order to provide the life that he felt we needed to have.
Yeah.
So that my mom didn't have to work. She could be home and raise us. And, you know, that was the only way that he knew how to do that. And it wasn't until I started working for him and really understood, you know, what he gave up and what he was really doing, that I had a more profound understanding of our relationship. And it was kind of one of those like, you know, kind of a jackass for not realizing that when I was younger, but
you never
also, you know, it never going to do it. And, yeah. You know, I just, the one thing I told him when I started working with him was that I'm not going to travel as much as he did. I'm just not. And it needed to be a place of, you know, he actually needed me and wanted me, just not a, you know, oh, I need somebody and my son, you know, can do this. So it's going to be a nepotism thing and I'm just going to hand him the keys to the castle, so to speak.
The empire.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it was fun. And working with family is, anybody who has ever done it, like, I give them a lot of respect. You know, some families get along very well. Some families don't. Like, when I first started working with my old man, it was like an episode of Orange County Choppers.
Yeah. Lots of slamming
the tunnels.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, oh, we were yelling at each other. And I mean, we could have had our own reality TV show.
Wow.
And it's one of those things where, you know, I was trying to flex my muscles, so to speak, and, you know, make it known that I wasn't there just because of my last name. And I wanted his respect for the actual position that I had. And it was him trying to say, all right, you're still a young, stupid kid. Like, yeah. You need to listen to me. You need to do this. And it was also a conflict of old school, new school, you know, like, oh, this is the way we've been doing it for 30 years. And here's the young buck trying to come in and, you know, change things up and, you know, get some fresh blood into the system.
Isn't that so weird to try to figure out, like, you know, I have my 2-year-old, 2.5-year-old, and I think that my dad dealt with me when I was 2.5. But that is so foreign to me because I was obviously 2.5 at the time. I didn't have a chance to think about that. But at some point, your kids, I mean, that dynamic of your relationship is going to change to the point where your kids are going to be soon you. And I wonder if your parents, and when I say you, I mean everyone's parents, thought the same thing. You know, when I have kids, I'm going to do these things different. And it's just the perpetual,
it's that life cycle. It's, you know, it's, I want better for my next generation. Mm-hmm. I want, I want to ensure that they're successful. I want to make sure they're safe. I want to make sure that they're provided for even after I'm gone.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I'm, that's, and I hate to say, like, at this stage in our lives, you know, our fathers are older. My father's 67, going on 68.
Yeah.
And, you know, he, at this stage in his life, he's talking about, you know, trust, you know, a trust that he set up and life insurance and, oh, all the arrangements are already taken care of when I pass away.
Yeah, isn't that morbid?
You know, it's like, and it's very morbid, but it's a reality. And it's, yeah, it's very, I think, very responsible of him that, you know, he's still, even in his, you know, death, he wants to be a responsible dad and make sure that we're taken care of.
Yeah.
And, you know, I look up to that and I, you know, I hope that I can, you know, be half the man that he is when I'm that age. And, and, you know, kind of talking about what you were saying earlier as far as like midlife crises and stuff, and I actually came across a picture of our family when I was, I want to say, probably 16 years old. It was a family portrait at my grandmother's house, and looking at the picture, I'm like, oh wow, like my parents look pretty good, like my aunt and uncles. And then it dawned on me that my parents were the age, or in that picture, were the age that I am right now.
Yeah.
And it was like, holy shit, like I'm that guy, like, right now, like, yeah, I'm my dad, you know, 30 years ago.
And
like,
in your brain, at least just, in my brain, like, whoa. In my brain, I'm still who I was. Like, I feel like I'm still the 22-year-old Kevin Sullivan, but I'm 38-year-old Kevin Sullivan, almost 39. And it's, I don't know, I guess everyone kind of goes through that. And then the other thing too is I used to really care about, or I used to really worry about the end. I'd be like, oh my God, what happens? You know, you stay up at night and you're like, what happens? What happens when it's over? And then that really freaks you out when you start thinking about, I mean, it can really freak you out. Like, you get the palpitations. Like,
well, you.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah. But no, then, and then something happened, and I think it might have been, you know, putting my life on the line out in Iraq, or, and I was still fighting my mortality in those years. So it didn't sit with me well.
Yeah.
Going into combat zones and everything never sat with me well. And it actually gave me some longstanding repercussions. But as I, you know, had kids and as I kind of relaxed a little bit, I relaxed a lot. I went from like a type A to I'm a way type B. I don't know if there's anything lower than a type B. I went from being the most uptight, wound up person to the most, I am so laid back, it's almost too laid back. And I just accept things as they come. And if, you know, tomorrow I
want to hang out with that Sully.
Yeah, it's pretty, it's actually very, you'll want to sleep most of the time because that's all I want to do. I just don't care anymore. I mean, I care, but I don't care about, I don't worry about it.
It doesn't wind you up and keep you
nothing
up.
Nothing winds me up. Nothing winds me up. Partly due to the medications too, that the Veterans Affairs gave me, but the other part because I accept. And once you accept things, and you don't fight.
Well, that's the thing too, talking about like children, like I see my 6-year-old and he is the exact replica of me when I was 6 years old and just would snap on a dime, have, you know, be so calm and collected. And like, you know, I'd like to think of myself as a very intellectual child, and he's a very smart kid, but if his little brother like looks at him the wrong way or like just taps him on the shoulder or like startles him, he just snaps.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh my God, like here's this little like ball of fire that just, you know, he gets so like wound up over the littlest things. And I'm like, all right, like it's going to take some time to calm him down. And it's going to take, you know, just some patience. And I think, again, like you said, you calm down. Like I've become so much more patient. Like I used to get upset about certain things, and you know, I've always tried to be calm and collected, and I've always tried to diffuse situations I think I use comedy in a lot of ways to kind of diffuse situations, kind of like doing the worm.
The worm, and, that's, know, still Boston. One of my, yeah. We're outside of the Bell in Hand, which is probably, people don't realize that you can walk around Boston and realize that you're a drunken fool outside of this 250-year-old bar, and that most likely Paul Revere or John Adams or somebody was there. Thomas Paine,
John the Barfight.
Yeah, I mean, there was just the our forefathers were in these streets, and here we are puking behind dumpsters and whatever. But yeah, I remember that. I don't even know what the occasion was. I feel like it was something. We were all out and
we were all just getting together in Boston, and you bumped into someone. And
oh, it was me that caused it.
Yeah, well, no, you didn't cause it. It was one of those like just meatheads that you just bumped into, and he must have just been having a bad day and wanted to get in your face. And then, of course, the bouncers were like, "Oh, you know, everybody out of here." So it was like out of like a 60s movie. It's like everybody spills out into the back alley.
I remember like being in the alley, and we're all lined up on either side.
And either side of the road, and like it's like everybody's yelling, and it's like you're just waiting for like one person to just do like the Braveheart, like, you know,
charge.
Cheer and run. And I don't know what came over me, but I thought it would be a good idea to just get down and do the worm to defuse the situation. And it went from everyone yelling at each other and like swearing and like saying, "I'm gonna kick your ass," to like, I think they were just confused what I was doing.
In the middle of
it, they started cheering for me, and I was like, "Yeah!" And then everybody forgot because everybody was drunk, and they're like, "Oh yeah!" And it's like everybody just walked their own ways.
So and, actually, that brings up a good point. Doing the worm in a wet alley. It was just, I remember, damp Gangs in New York style back alley of like some Boston tavern, and I remember getting heated, and then
on cobblestone, said, mind you, last.
Yeah, I think it was a birthday, because I think we came actually back to your place where you are right now. I think that happened because we're out with all your buddies. I remember getting pulled over though by a cop, and I'm like, "Oh my god, we're getting pulled over!" And then it was one of your friends. and then as we're getting pulled over, keep in mind this is 10 years ago. The statute of limitations is over. You get out of the car. I had no idea it was your friend. I just see a cop pull up behind us. People are getting out, and then you get in the cop car and you drive away. That was the night of the worm. I want to say that you actually stole the police car.
Now you're just making stuff up.
Is this something that shouldn't be on the podcast? Should I remove this? Is that
No.
Is that person still a cop?
I did take my friend's cop car, but that was a different time.
But to not know, because this was back with all your friends that you grew up with, and I didn't know who was who, and I remember just, first of all, someone was driving down the back roads at ridiculous speeds, and then the cop lights come on behind us, and we get pulled over, and I'm like, "Oh my god, we're all going to jail," and then everyone jumps out of the car and jumps on the cop, and it's a big just brouhaha, but everyone knows each other, and then you got into the police car and started driving away or something like that, and I was like, "What planet am I on?"
The good old days.
Try that now. My friend Mike Stojic, the other Mike on this program, he said he hooked up this setup and he had no feedback. And all I'm getting is feedback, so I don't know. I apologize to the three listeners. That's the can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it keeps going in now.
Crap. All right, we'll see what we can.
He seems like a fun guy.
Yeah, Mike's an interesting dude. Mike's got a big old beard down about here. He's former Marine, power lifter type of guy. Just lots of fun. He actually got me into whiskey. You just kind of meet people that you just kind of just get along with. And we were out at, it was like a local, party. It was for, I don't even know.
I want to move to your neighborhood. Like, it seems like your neighborhood is a lot of fun.
It's unbelievable.
Like an interesting like melting pot of like so many different like backgrounds and.
Well, what it is we all moved here at around the same time. I mean, we still got a few people coming in, but I mean the neighborhood was just basically built, and then people started moving in. So everyone's new. Nobody's really from North Carolina. There's a couple. Maybe two families that are from North Carolina. Everyone else is just new to the area. So we just kind of set up a Facebook page and almost every other weekend there's some sort of party going on or something going on.
That's awesome.
And just get to get to know everyone. Like last week's podcast, I had Paul on, and he's just an interesting dude. Mike's interesting. Malia is interesting.
Now, do you feel that it's because of the circumstances of just having a new development and everybody's new to it, so they want to meet people? Do you feel it's just a Southern thing that people
No one's Southern
welcoming?
No one's there are a few, but no, it's right. It's I call where we live, you've seen the tall blue people that were on a movie, and they Avatar.
Oh, okay. I'm like, where are you going with this one?
So the tall blue people had in the movie, you remember they would go off the reservation, they come back and be arrows stuck in the wheels and stuff like that. Did you ever see it?
Yeah.
That's what I feel like here. So we are in the deep South. Like Raleigh is Raleigh. It's like it's very eclectic. There's lots of different people up there, but you get down where we are and we are in the South. We are in moonshine country. But our little development is like a bubble. It's
boy,
like
you got a pretty mouth.
Yeah, that's sort of what it is. And we drive off the and like basically I'm saying is I come home at night and I have arrows sticking out of my tires. Like it's this little bubble of the North, and then I love them. I wouldn't, if I didn't like the South, I wouldn't have moved back here from New York. I mean, it's great. But no, the reason why everyone gets along, I think, is because we just, most people are transplants, and we're like, well, all we have is each other, so we just all started just hanging out, and it's everyone's cool. There has yet to be a neighbor that moves in where everyone's like, avoid that person. So it's fun. And
it's gonna suck for that person when they do move to that neighborhood.
Yeah, they do. Or the one person that's like, how come no one's invited me to anything? Yeah. So I was going to get into all these really deep existential things, but I really kind of do want to, because I love that sort of talk, and I want to get your insight on it.
Yeah, no, definitely. Well, so, I mean, I feel like we've just been talking about, like...
And we covered a lot of this.
We've just been catching up, which... No, I know, but I feel like we've just been catching up, and, like, I feel bad for, like, your listeners. You go from, like, your last podcast with Paul to, like, you know, talking philosophy, and like, all
doing
these,
the worm,
like,
in a back alley.
And then, yeah, it's like, oh, yeah, remember that time when we were, like, drunk on gin and, like, punching, like, mirrors off of cars?
I do remember that. Awesome. I do remember that. No, you were the one punching mirrors. I was in the back.
No, you were.
I would never... Look at my hands. I got little... I've always...
You were throwing bags of trash at me.
Oh, yeah, that probably happened. But I'm looking back, and we covered everything. But what I was going to get to is the, and we were going to talk about how do you measure success, but we did that. Is it necessary to stress about anything at all? I mean, it really isn't in the grand scheme of things. And I think that's why I became, so I find myself, let's say I'm at work and someone comes in, and there's times for me to stress when someone comes in with chest pain or something. I don't want them to die. So I stress in the sense that, in a good stress, I'm like, good, let's work on this person. But in the grand scheme of things, If someone comes in and says, or let's not even talk about my job. I mean, if I hear people complaining about a family member or complaining about an argument they had at work, I literally can no longer understand it, because I've reduced my life in a good way to being a little naked monkey, a little pink body on a rock hurtling through space. And no matter what I do, even if I think I'm doing the most important decision, I'm not going to be Julius Caesar. And even Julius Caesar, as important as he thinks he is, he's going to be forgotten once a giant meteor hits this place. Nothing matters. All that matters is what you have and what you can feel. And whether there's something at the end of this or whether there's something... do you remember how long it took for you to be born? No. It took no time at all. Do you know how long it's going to take after we die? Most likely, it's not going to take no time at all. It's this point in here that makes the difference. And could it be that something after is there? Yeah, it could be. I don't stress over it anymore. I'm more focused on doing the right thing now and being righteous in my decisions and easing whatever suffering I can through my job and raising good kids and not thinking about anything that... I mean, I drop something on the floor and it gashes my hardwood floors. It's a piece of wood. I don't care.
It's not the end of the world.
Nothing is actually the end of the world except the end of the world or whenever you stop breathing. And that has made all the difference, because I really, I just, I can't be bothered with anything. I pretend I am, but I just can't be. I'm like, all right, yeah, that's horrible. You really, your alarm didn't go off and your coffee was not good and you had, you stubbed your toe. Oh, that sucks.
It's kind of funny. It's kind of funny to relate back in just a quick story about one of the things I learned from my father and I still use to this day when I go over to China. And it still is such a difference in just common sense and a cultural understanding of how to deal with your daily routine and problems.
Right.
And one of my problems with my associates, and you know, I've been working for the company for just over 16 years, and it's one of those things that has just never really changed, is that a lot of the people from the factory that we work with, if there's ever an issue that arises, whether it's small or big, they have this desire and need to just not tell anybody about it and try and fix it before you find out about it. That's okay. It's one of the things, and I've dealt with many different factories, and it's one of those things that's just, it's ingrained in them that if they come to a manager with a problem, the manager immediately scolds them and says, that's your problem, take care of it. And so they've been just ingrained growing up and conditioned that they need to try to fix the problem before you ever find out about it. Well, the problem with that is that, you know, in our world of shipping and logistics and all that, if you don't fix a problem before a certain date, there's a cutoff time that, okay, you need to ship product for the next Christmas. It's like, okay, we need to ship product by June in order to get it in time for the retailers to get to their warehouses and distribution centers and get to store level, so that, you know, as soon as back to school stuff is done, they can set up for Halloween and then they can set up for Christmas. I'm sure you're already seeing that in your retailers near you. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that because of this ingrained sense of wanting to hide it and like just ball it up and not deal with it, they end up causing more problems than it's worth. So like it's like the snowball effect. Like, start out as this little problem, it starts, you know, snowballing, getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and then before you know it, if something was supposed to ship on the 1st of September, well, we know it was supposed to ship on the 1st of September, but it's the last day in August and now it's not going to ship till the 20th of September, even though they knew about it in April, but they're telling you the day before it's supposed to ship. And it's one of those things that they get so stressed out. And there's been all these different studies, and you know, there was a thing probably like 2 or 3 years ago with I want to say it was Qualcomm or one of the manufacturers, a very, very high IT manufacturer, that they had this release and there was a lot of defectives, and the owner of the factory actually committed suicide because he was so stressed out and basically just felt that he failed his company and failed this and did that and everything. And I relate it to the first time I ever went to China. I've kind of learned from my father, and he had this meeting with all the staff, and it was mostly the senior management, and it was one of those things where just trying to relate common sense and put things in perspective. And everybody was sitting around their little tables in this big conference room, and he got up from his desk and, you know, broke protocol of, you know, standing at the podium, like, because everybody's supposed to stand at the podium, and you know, nobody ever interacts with each other, and so he started walking around. And he picked out, you know, the new person of the group, and he went over to him and he said, "What's the worst thing that can happen to you today?" And the first thing that came out of the person's mouth was, "I could do my job wrong and my manager would be upset." He's like, nope, that's not the worst thing that could happen to you today. "What's the worst thing that could happen to you today?" "I could upset my wife and do this and that." He's like, nope, "What's the worst thing?" Bang! And he takes his finger and like points at him like a gun and just yells, "Bang!" He's like, "I could pull out my gun and shoot you in the head. You could be dead. That is the worst thing that could happen to you today. So if that doesn't happen, you know what? You're having an okay day."
That's right.
And it would just be like a moment of silence, and everybody would just look at each other being like, "Oh, yeah, I guess that is the worst thing that could happen. Like, I could be dead. So, like, when it goes from, like, a perspective of, oh, the absolute worst thing that could possibly happen to me today is that I piss off my manager, to I could die. But they never take the time to actually think about that and, like, quantify their time here. And, you know, I like to say that I work so that I can live. I don't live so that I can work.
Right.
And over there, it's the opposite. Like, they work, they live to work. Like, that's what, you know, and I don't want to classify everyone, because not everyone over there is like that. But the majority of people that I deal with, they work until they're, you know, 80 years old, and then their family takes care of them, and then they die.
Yeah.
And, like, they travel occasionally and, you know, see a few things, but their work is their life.
It's just a complete culture difference.
And it's so different.
And it's, you know, the weird thing is, it's just life, everything should be a cakewalk until those last moments where we all have to face it.
Yeah.
Like I think I said on the email to you, I said, it's so far out of our mind. Death is so far out of your mind that you don't, I mean, you might think about it in passing, but when you really start thinking about that, yes, you are, no kidding, going to have to face that at some day. There's no doubt about it. You are going to have to face it in at some day. That's when it really starts to freak. It really starts to freak me out a little bit.
Well, so it's one of those things where I honestly think, and I'm not just saying this just to say it, but I think even when I was in college and, you know, being a dumb kid doing, you know, stupid things that I probably should have died multiple times, like, even then, I think I had an outlook of, you know what, if I died tomorrow, like, I'd be content. Like, I've lived a full life. Like, and this is at, like, the age of, like, 19, 20. Like,
yeah.
You know, so I'm, you know, 38 going on 39, and I'm, you know, kind of living on borrowed time right now in my life. Like, yeah, okay, hey, if I make it to 50, I'm doing okay.
Well, wait till we start being able to download our brains. Then we'll be okay. Then we'll be around forever, so it won't matter. Here's a question for you. Let's say you replace one neuron in your brain, okay? You have a bad neuron. We put some medicine in there. We replace one with, like, a plastic neuron. All right, so now let's say we replace 5%. We're like, hey, I know you have Parkinson's. Let's replace 5% of your brain with these little electrodes. Okay, and then they inject you, and then they go in there, and they replace your Parkinson's. That's my little hand doing the... when you do these little hand signals, it's radio. They can't see that. So I'm making a little thing of my hand, whatever. So they replace 5% of your brain with these little electrodes. Okay, great. You feel better. Oh, you're starting, you know, the symptoms are coming back. All right, let's replace 25%. So now they replace 25%. Then they replace 50%. At what point do you die, and does this fake robot thing take over? You? Yeah. At what point does it happen? Because if you lose your leg, you're still you. You lose both legs, you're still you. You lose both legs, both arms, you're still you. If in the future we can make new hearts and new livers, and so all your organs are starting to get replaced, you're still you. But once you replace your brain, if it thinks it's you, is it still you?
Well, I think it goes back. I mean, there's so many different, like, outlooks on this, and, you know, there's been, you know, the cheesy movies that have been made of, like, you know, people that get eye transplants, and it's like, oh, where does the soul reside? You know, the eyes are the doorway to the soul, so to speak. And, you know, I think it was like a Jessica Alba movie or something like that, where she was a blind woman and, you know, had an eye transplant. And
it sounds intriguing. Keep going. You watched a tearjerker, like, Jessica Alba movie. Oh, yeah. Go ahead. Oh, no. You can admit it.
You know, it's one of those things. I get sucked into terrible movies and I just can't turn them off. Like, I'm a sucker for terrible movies. You know, ask me, like, who was in them, or besides Jessica Alba, obviously. Yeah. No, but I think the premise of the movie was, like, she was a blind girl and, like, got an eye transplant, and it ended up being that the eyes were transplanted from, like, the serial killer, and it started giving her, like, these thoughts, and, like, she was seeing, like, memories of what the serial killer had done, and then she was finding herself, like, showing up in random places, and it's like it all comes down to, it's like, okay, like, yes, the brain has, you know, everything going on in it, and at what point, like you said, is it 10%, 20%, 30%, 40%, 50%, like, how much of it contains you, or what you consider to be you.
Yeah, where that little thing that you say, no, I'm me. I, you know, that little thing in the back of your head that they call, or as Paul Adams, who was on here, would call the ghost in the machine. Is it truly your soul, or what is it? Is it just a, who knows? Who knows what it is? Why is it behind our eyes? Because that's where we see and that's where we perceive, you know, that's where everything's perceived. Yeah. Why isn't it in our toe? Yeah. You lose your big toe, you didn't lose your soul. It's right here. Yeah.
They're doing it. Was it in Russia that they're doing the first head transplant?
Are they really?
On a human?
I wouldn't doubt it. I know they tried to keep a dog's head alive for a while, and they hooked up, they basically took the head off the dog and hooked up a bypass machine and kept it alive for, I don't remember how long.
Some like say RoboCop?
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much, yeah.
I just saw things for, like, they're planning, they've already planned the procedure for, like, 2017. To take part in this full head transplant of this human, and it's one of those things, like, you know, they say we only use 10% of our brain, so it's like, all right, well, what percentage of that is who we are?
Or, that's actually, you know, the 10% is actually a misnomer. It's actually, we're conscious of 10% of our brain's actions. Yeah, that's true. That's a big thing that's been I guess debunked. I don't know. Yeah. What do I know? I'm just drinking some good whiskey and having a discussion.
I only use 8% of my brain.
My brain.
Bill Schwartzky, he used 18%
of his brain. Yeah. Why do you think the universe exists? This is my part of my podcast. So what I'm doing with the last, what are we on, 17 now? Did I say 16 or 17? We're on 16?
16, I think.
Okay. What I'm trying to do with the podcast is every time we have an episode, I try to come up with, I'm honing in on what happens and or what the basics are going to be. And what it's slowly becoming, and I brought this up in the last podcast, is barstool philosophy. So I like to get to know the person, or in your case, I already knew you, but we get to, like, to let the audience get to know you. And then we add, then you're sitting on a barstool. And if
I'm sitting on a barstool.
Actually, give me a... Right there. I'm going to actually snap a photo on this, and we're going to get... There we go. And that's going to go on the podcast. So,
the official click.
Yep. So now the background, he's at a bar that... obviously, you built that. It looks nice. It's not an IKEA bar.
This is from... This is the head of a buffet that we use the bottom for our baby's changing table.
All right. So, very good.
I took the top and built it into a bar.
All right. bar/... Baby table, great.
I'm going to market that. That's copyright protected.
All right. So we can't. So basically, what I'm trying to get to is interesting people and barstool philosophy. And I want to find out what everyone's take is on what this all means, why the hell we're here, what, enjoy some whiskey and try to figure it all out. And the beauty of this, and what I love about podcasts, is that it's available for anyone, anytime, even our kids in 50 years.
Yeah. No, that'd be awesome.
So they would listen to this and be like, my dad was a philosophical
asshole. my dad was the jackass that I thought he was.
Yeah. I always thought he was so smart. Then I listened to his podcast and he just blabbered for an hour and a half every couple of weeks. And for some reason,
insert your son's voice here.
Did you know, by the way, I have eight to 10. I don't remember where I'm at right now. Listeners in China. One in Iran, a couple in Kyrgyzstan. So, and I think it all comes down to whatever I write on the title. So for a while there, I was talking with my neighbor who is an IT expert. And so IT, United States, all the Chinese started listening. Yeah, honest to God, I think that's what happened. And then I don't know where I'm getting the Kurds or the Kyrgyzstanis or whatever they're called. I have no idea.
The Kurds.
Kurds, you know, those are northerner. Actually, I flew with the Kurds.
No, you're gonna be on some list now. That's a word you can't use anymore.
That's right. I shouldn't have used American. I apologize. So, any plugs you want to get out there as we wrap this up?
So, Maxim Enterprise, maker of fine wooden products. Try to do it in an ecological way that's earth friendly and safe for your children.
What do you think about Melissa and Doug? What are they? Are they total assholes or are they your friends?
Melissa and Doug, I honestly, they're one of our major competitors. You know, they started out, you know, a small company, you know, trying to do a similar thing, similar philosophy of just, you know, getting product out there. It's one of those things. I know a few people that work there that are great people. I know a few people that work there that are complete assholes. it's one of those things. It's like anything, you know, within my company, there's assholes. So it's, you know, I have nice things to say about them. I have bad things to say about them. It's, you know, they've done a very, very, I will say they've done a very, very good job in marketing their product. It's a household name, and they were able to somewhat transition from what we call the specialty world, which is like the small mom and pop shops,
right,
into the mass market, which is like the Walmarts and Targets.
Yeah, they're everywhere. Everywhere. Everything we get. I'm like, listen, Doug.
Yeah. So it's one of those things where they've marketed themselves well enough that because they started out in the small mom and pop like specialty stores that can demand a higher retail, that people just became ingrained with paying that price. So when you go to a Target or something like that, you're still willing to pay that price.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if you really look at what you're getting, like in being in the retail business, markup is ridiculous. Yeah. Like, you know, if you look at a set of like, they do like a set of alphabet blocks, like I'm not going to share our numbers, but if we were to do a set of blocks that they do, it would be like a third of the cost.
Wow.
And because their name's associated with it, like they did a very good job of building their brand.
Yeah.
To the point where people, you know, that name, you yeah. might not know any other wooden toy name, but you know that name.
Yeah.
And even before also, you had kids, you might have had friends that had kids that you heard that name.
Yeah, and it's so as a product of, I guess, marketing or as a victim, if you want to use this marketing, I look at that, I'm like, all right, I know it's in my mind, I'm like, all right, it's well made and it's not going to poison the kids, so here you go. Yep. Which I guess anything that comes over is really technically supposed to not be poisoning the kids, right? Is there rules against yes. that?
Well, it's so funny, like how lackadaisical the rules become when it goes to your specialty stores.
Yeah.
So the Walmarts, Targets, Toys R Us's of the world, they have to be held to such high standards because they're importing product. But if I were to make toys out of my house and sell them to a local store,
yeah,
there's absolutely no testing, no government, you know, standards that they need to follow. It's just the store buying it from a third party, and yeah, it might be safe. Or I might have used, you know, I might have used
puppy's blood to paint it and turpentine.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's so ridiculous how skewed like the standards are, and the Consumer Product Safety Division just does not have the resources to get out and get to these small, you know, outlets to really test product properly.
Yeah.
So I would say in any given specialty store, there's probably 20% of the product that would not pass any government safety standards. Wow. At any given time. Yeah, and it's crazy because these are toys that people are putting on shelves and giving to their kids, and you know, and stuff like Etsy and, you know, Pinterest, like where you can buy stuff that's homemade. Excuse me, people are making, you know, infant rattles and teethers that they're giving to babies that don't pass small parts tests. And,
so what makes the rattle noise is some of my expired Xanax.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's like going back to like the old like 70s like Dan Aykroyd, like,
oh yeah, glass.
You know, like, hey, you know, I got a bag of glass. And, you know, yeah, you know, like, so like you're
Johnny Switchblade
with the asbestos. You know, no, that's some good stuffing right there. Yeah. Like,
that's funny. I wish we started talking about this like 45 minutes ago, because I would have had more battery life, and it would have been cool to talk about. But that's why it's the beauty of the Wait What If podcast with Barstool Philosophy, and all the stuff we can talk about is we can have you on again as long as you had fun. Did you have fun?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, because it's a good time to sit around, drink some fine whiskey. What were you drinking, by the way? What did you end up going with?
Today I went with the Michter's.
Ah, okay.
Michter's.
Oh, so the stuff that actually did.
It's a nice original sour mash whiskey out of distilled and bottled in Pennsylvania.
That is the stuff that came out of your grandfather's place.
From, I believe this, it doesn't even have a date, but I believe it was probably bottled in, oh wait, does it have a date right here? This is probably like 1967.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's 1967.
So it was probably a $5 bottle of whiskey at the time, but
yep.
Tastes like a very, very good whiskey right now.
That's good. And it's what's amazing about that, it was 2 years before you even went to the moon. And did I see you mixing that with something?
Just ice.
Oh, okay. Whew. I saw the bottle and I thought you were. Hold on. Do that again.
Just drinking it.
I was going to snap a photo of my. This will be for my friend Mike, or the co-host. He's got his podcast, Make It a Double, which I don't know if you had a chance to check out. It's a good podcast.
I've heard a lot of talk about it, but I haven't had a chance to check it out because
it's very good.
It seems like every time he talks about it, it's, oh yeah, I've got like episode 3 or 4.
Yeah,
and he started talking about that on episode 2 or 3 of your podcast. And
he works.
You gotta start giving him a hard time. Like, yeah, episode 16, and you know he's got like 3.
He works. He just does a lot of editing. It's very, very long, slow process. So. I told
so he's
him
a little more professional is what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah. Me, I have this freaking feedback that's been going on this whole time, this tapping, which everyone's going to hear, which I apologize. I don't know how this is going to sound. This is the first time I ever did a remote interview, so bear with me. It's just some tapping. Get over it.
We can do 16.2 if you want.
All right, yeah. We can do whatever. We'll bring you on again. What's the website that they can check out for your stuff?
www.maximenterprise.com.
Okay, www.maximenterprise.com.
And we actually have a another website which is linked to our Earth Friendly brand of product called EverEarth, and that's everearthglobal.com.
everearthglobal.com. All right, make sure you check it out. Chris, thanks for coming on. I'm going to start playing my closing song, which you can't hear because of the way this remote thing works. But I'm hearing some really good music.
I'll start right doing now. The worm.
Yeah, there you go. All right, you have listened to the Wait What If podcast. As always, I am your host, Kevin Sullivan. I went solo tonight. We had Chris Millington on of Maxim Enterprise and my good friend from years, and now it's becoming decades and decades ago. Which, by the way, Chris, you know what I forgot to bring up? The whole fact that you were the best man at my wedding. I guess it's something. Yes. I guess you have to bring up.
It's just a little, yeah,
just a little thing that happened at one point.
A little caveat.
Yeah. So yeah, that's Chris.
My wedding too, man.
I was at your wedding, wasn't I? And I was wearing a tux and all that crazy stuff.
You were in my wedding, not just that. Yeah.
Nah, I remember that whole. Yeah. Yeah. Good stuff. What else? No one ever writes me. Just freaking send me an email. Hey, you got a new tattoo? Let me see that one. Under your arm there. That's badass. You got your whole arm inked up. Man, that's pretty sweet. You make Mike's inked up like that from pretty much the elbows up. You're making him look like a wimp. Anything else going on? You got a booby tattoo?
Well, I can't show you that. I don't want you to see a picture of a snapshot.
That's funny. I tell Kara, I'm like, I would get a
sleeve. You got one, right?
I got a few.
You got one, right?
I would get a sleeve if I could, but I'm a PA and I walk in with, I'm a lazy PA, so I wear, no, I take that back.
Just wear long sleeves.
I don't like to wear, by lazy PA, I mean, I don't like to wear a tie and a shirt and all that, so I wear scrubs, and unfortunately, from the elbow up, everyone sees, so I can't do that.
This is what I wear to work.
Nice.
I wear t-shirts and shorts.
All right, so that's it. Whatever podcast this was, 16 or 17 or 15, I don't know. Catch us next time. Thank you for listening.